I'm longtime journalist and brand new podcaster Meg Heckman, and this is Radio Free Dystopia, a podcast that explores what we learn when dystopian fiction and current events start to look the same. I'm here with my co-host, dystopian novelist Toby Ball. Hi, Toby. How you doing?
Hey, good. Happy Science March Day. How are you doing?
Excellent, excellent. Our very special guest today is math professor, puzzle constructor, and semi-professional podcast personality, Mike Nothnagel. Thanks for joining us, Mike. How are you?
Well, thank you for having me, Meg. I'm doing very well.
We're talking today about something that has a lot of names. Deception, doublespeak, propaganda, misinformation, disinformation, spin, and lately, alternative facts.
And Peggy.
Peggy?
That's a Hamilton reference.
Oh, God. Oh, so my daughter just walks around the house singing Hamilton songs.
I kind of like your daughter sounds like a very nice person to hang out with. Sorry, it will only be one of 16 or 17,000 Hamilton
that's,
references
that's
I will try to put
that's
in.
That's the only
today.
Hamilton references we're getting. That's good.
That's only great. One of this next 5 seconds.
Okay.
All right.
I'll miss them all, but that's...
Great. So anyway, what we're talking about today is alternative facts. And we could spend an entire episode on just recent real life examples of this. But to get us started, I am going to run us through just a few recent headlines.
Time for another fact-filled edition of The News from Dystopia.
The Rise of Alternative Facts. In a January 22, 2017 Meet the Press interview, Kellyanne Conway, a top advisor to President Donald Trump, used the term alternative facts to describe the administration's false statement that Trump's inauguration drew a record-breaking crowd. This, by the way, has been debunked by tons of independent news organizations using a lot of different techniques. Within days of Conway's interview and statement, George Orwell's 1984 jumped to the top of bestseller lists and actually sold out on Amazon. The weirdest example of all of this has been dubbed Pizzagate, or hashtag Pizzagate if you're checking it out on Twitter. And that term refers to a thoroughly debunked conspiracy theory that links Democratic National Committee officials and people working on Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign with a non-existent child sex ring that was run out of a DC pizza parlor, again, according to this theory.
Because in part, one of their pieces of evidence is that the phrase cheese pizza and child pornography have the same initials. And so clearly the phrase cheese pizza is a code for child pornography, because there would be no other reason that a pizza parlor would be talking about cheese pizzas.
Right. I mean, that makes perfect sense, right? I mean,
exactly.
Come on. Like, if you're not believing that, sheeple. Yeah, I mean,
Chris Paul, Chaz Palminteri, they're all solid.
Right, cat poop. Yeah, like so many other things that start with C and P.
It's a
yeah.
conspiracy.
So this whole crazy thing existed online and then started to exist in the real world when a 28-year-old guy from North Carolina by the name of Edgar Madison Welch showed up at this pizza parlor with an assault rifle to investigate this non-existent child sex trafficking ring. At some point during his investigation, the rifle went off. People were terrified. They had to evacuate the pizza parlor. And this whole thing, again, thoroughly debunked. He pled guilty to some charges related to that last month. And the whole thing should have gone away. It did not. In fact, at the tail end of March, a number of people assembled to call for an investigation into Pizzagate at a protest across the street from the White House. As of this time, there's been no formal investigation that we know into Pizzagate. And as a matter of fact, Alex Jones recently apologized for his role in spreading the rumors around this. And that's saying something given the quality of the disinformation that's usually on his website.
This has been the news from Dystopia. Until next time, stay hopeful.
A lot of the conversation around this idea of alternative facts cites a very specific and really iconic passage from 1984. And so Toby has actually brought his trusty copy of 1984 with him to the studio today, and he's going to read that passage for us.
I'm actually going to read a couple passages.
Awesome.
But I'll start with the iconic one that you referenced. It was as though some huge force were pressing down upon you, something that penetrated inside your skull, battering against your brain, frightening you out of your beliefs, persuading you, almost, to deny the evidence of your senses. In the end, the party would announce that 2 and 2 made 5, and you would have to believe it. It was inevitable that they should make that claim sooner or later. The logic of their position demanded it. Not merely the validity of experience, but the very existence of external reality was tacitly denied by their philosophy. The heresy of heresies was common sense. And what was terrifying was not that they would kill you for thinking otherwise, but that they might be right. For after all, how do we know that 2 and 2 make 4, or that the force of gravity works, or that the past is unchangeable? If both the past and the external world exist only in the mind, if the mind itself is controllable, what then?
I was led to believe there would be no math.
Mike, why do you think you're here?
So the second part is from in 1984. The protagonist Winston finds this book, which is sort of this philosophy against the government, and this part of it is sort of the beginning of when he starts talking about the concept of doublethink. Doublethink means the power of holding two contradictory beliefs in one's mind simultaneously and accepting both of them. The party intellectual knows in which direction his memories must be altered. He therefore knows that he is playing tricks with reality. But by the exercise of doublethink, he also satisfies himself that reality is not violated. The process has to be conscious, or it would not be carried out with sufficient precision, but it also has to be unconscious, or it would bring with it a feeling of falsity and hence of guilt. So those are sort of the two passages that explain doublethink and sort of the way that the government in 1984 wants people in the party to experience reality, is that it's something that's coming externally to them from the party, despite what they sort of experience with their own eyes. And I think, you know, going back to what we were just talking about with Pizzagate and Alex Jones is somebody who, and this has been called into question just in the last couple of weeks because he's on trial and his lawyer sort of claiming that he's in fact a performance artist, which he then came on and sort of disputed. But I've always wondered if he was sort of, his stuff is sometimes so outlandish. I can't believe anybody really takes it seriously. But people do. Apparently this guy who went in and wanted to shoot up the pizza parlor.
Right.
So Meg.
Yes.
So what I thought was kind of interesting about this and, it also has to do with Winston's job in 1984, which is he goes back and he basically scrubs newspapers from the past. He's trying to scrub the record so that people can't go back and be like, hey, man, you said this and then you did this and claimed. Now, that's not the case. I mean, you can go back, you know, and fact check just about anybody and find video or audio of it. But with our current president, that doesn't seem to be an issue.
Not only does it not seem to be an issue, but you brought up Twitter before, and that is a very, to me anyway, an interesting version of that, where people can literally go back to people's Twitter timelines and quote the original tweet and then point out that they very recently said quite literally the opposite or something that contradicts the original tweet. In a very direct way. And it's almost become, I don't want to make light of it, it's almost become a sport to go back to a certain person's timeline and say, hey, remember when you said this and then you did the thing that is the opposite of that? How about that?
Journalism interns across the country are picking through the president's Twitter archive, I'm sure. And yeah, I mean, Twitter, as much chaos as it has caused, it also creates this other system of checking people because it puts people on the record, for better or worse. And so I think that's how we're seeing journalism adapt to this idea of competing realities. And, you know, I think it's important to point out that all politicians spin stuff. I mean, that's just part of the game. And all good, responsible journalists attempt to contextualize and, when appropriate, debunk that spin. And that should happen regardless of political party, regardless of who's in the White House. But the tone and the substance of what is coming out of this administration is definitely different in so many ways. And it's clearly not just me as a professional journalist who feels that way. I mean, clearly people were buying 1984 like it was going to get scrubbed from the libraries everywhere. And it was because it resonated with them, this idea of 2 + 2 = 5 because the government says so, which actually brings me to a question I want to ask you, Mike, because there will be math on this episode.
Dang it.
Is there a scenario in which 2 + 2 can = 5?
No.
Never.
No. No. Not in any sense of the math systems that we use today, what we know is addition. And
what about alternative math
can
systems?
Can we get nerdy for a second here?
We're going to, aren't we?
All right.
Toby, can we get nerdy?
It's kind of the point.
Perfect. Okay.
All right. So, I mean, no. Under our current, like, what we know is math, no. 2 + 2 can = 5, right? I saw an example once where somebody said, well, if you have certain calculators can display numbers in different ways. You can have them display different numbers of decimals and things like that, right? So somebody said, well, if you wanted to, you could do something like type in the number 2.49. And if you had it set up so that the calculator only displayed the whole number, it would display the number 2, but in its memory, it would still have 2.49. And then you could say plus, and then do 2.49 again, and the same thing would happen. It would only display the 2, but in its memory, it would still have the whole decimal. And so really, the number you've asked it to give you as the answer is 4.98. But again, because it's going to round it to the whole number, it's going to say 5. So in that sense, you could say 2 because of what it says on the screen plus 2 equals 5. But that's splitting the splittingest of hairs to get there. You know, so it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek answer to the question, can 2 + 2 = 5? The answer is yes, if you rig it up very, very, very specifically to do that. But no, not in any true mathematical sense. Can I was trying to think of, again, being nerdy, things like modular arithmetic or clock arithmetic. Like, we have 12 numbers on a clock, and when it goes from, you know, 10 o'clock 5 hours later, we don't call that, under the 12-hour system, we don't call it 15 o'clock. We call it 3 o'clock, you know.
For people who listen to Toby's other podcast, he has a thing with clocks. So
clock
maybe
metaphors.
We should not.
Oh. Although I think your example for 2 + 2 = 5 is actually a really good metaphor,
right?
In that when you're giving, you know, partial information about things, the conclusions that you draw may and probably won't be accurate. When I was reading a couple days ago to get ready for this, that those passages in Orwell, one of the things that kind of struck me is that Orwell, while describing this, like, you know, horrible dystopian society, still had this feeling that people were going to want some kind of, I guess it's not really verification, but there was a necessity to make sure that the lies were backed up by sort of fake facts. But that the reality is now, like today, what we found is a large swath of people in the United States, you know, can be lied to, can be shown that they've been lied to, but it doesn't really matter. And that seems to me like a step beyond where Orwell was willing to go, in that he felt like people were, you were going to be lied to, and that you kind of would know it and would come to accept it in a certain way, but that there also had to be this framework that was built up around these lies in order to, you know, make sure that people kind of had those in mind. Whereas now, that doesn't seem to be like, it seems like you can just kind of say anything. People can point to all kinds of reasons why that's a lie, and it doesn't matter.
Right. And in 1984, Orwell imagined this entire infrastructure, all of these kind of worker bees going back and rebuilding the past and scrubbing the news and making the archives fit the reality that they wanted to create. And we don't need that. It's not that hard. And I think for me, that's one of the things that has been the most striking in reconsidering 1984 through the lens of current events. It is so easy for a rumor or a falsehood, whether accidental or intentional, to just completely control the narrative. You know, there are two different things that we're talking about here, really. There's misinformation, which is, you know, what some people would call an honest mistake. You know, as a working journalist, try really, really hard. I triple check everything, but every once in a while, I'm a human being and there might be an error. So someone's middle initial is J and I wrote it down as G and I feel awful and I correct it and move on. And that kind of human error is hard enough to combat. But then when we start talking about actual active construction of alternative realities, it becomes incredibly difficult to ground our civic discussions in shared fact.
Well, I think what you're talking about is motivation.
Right.
I think the reason, if that's the word, for the misleading information is the motivation of the person behind it. And the example that comes to mind is the photographs of the inauguration, where the official photographs from the National Park Service, here's what it looked like the last time, here's what it looked like the time before. And they're different, right? There are different numbers of people in the photos. And the National Park Service has no dog in the hunt, right? Here we are. We're just giving you.
Well, they might now, but.
Okay, fair enough, right. But here are the pictures. Like, this is what they looked like, right? As a matter of sort of information, public record, whatever you want to call it, right? Here they are, right? And then, of course, I'll use the word backlash to that. The pictures were taken at different times. You didn't wait until everybody was on the National Mall, and it's a different angle, and it's from this and from that, right? And all of the ways to back solve the narrative in some sense to say, this is why these pictures are different, even though I know they're not, even though I know that they're analogous pictures to each other. I'm going to invent a story. I'm going to convince myself of things that make me believe that there's malice in this comparison. Right.
This idea of different realities or competing realities drives journalists nuts. I think it makes it incredibly hard for us to do our jobs. It makes it really hard for just average citizens who want to be informed when they vote. It makes it really hard for them to do that. But when it comes to fiction, it's super cool. And so, Toby, as the novelist in the room, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what makes the mystique of multiple competing realities so enticing.
So the using sort of competing realities in fiction, I think, you know, when you're writing, you're always looking at where's the conflict, and you know, there can be simple conflict, there can be complicated conflict, but when you have the idea of having competing realities allows you to have such sort of rich opportunities for comment on things that you're interested. So, you know, when you're writing fiction, I think for most people, you know, there's something that you want to make a statement about in some way, or something that you at least want to analyze. And the competing realities thing allows you to sort of contextualize different points and then have a protagonist or some sort of action try and sort of sort of mediate between those two points and come to some conclusions. A book that I read a couple years ago called The City and the City by China Mieville, I think is how you pronounce his last name, but it's a cool book. I think they're actually making a BBC series about it, but the premise is essentially, and it's definitely dystopian,
okay,
is that there's a city and there's two sort of ethnic groups, and the way they've decided that they can live together is that they completely ignore each other. So 50% of the population just does not make eye contact, speak to, or acknowledge the other 50% of the population. And that's kind of the agreement they've made. And the book is about how this breaks down in a way. But that, again, that was his way of kind of taking a look at, and I think this happens, you know, in real life, in these ethnic, these age-old ethnic antagonisms, where looking back at a similar history, they're drawing different conclusions about who did what to whom.
Right, but I mean, that's really different, though, from, you know, looking at, and I mean, that's just kind of part of the human condition, right? Like, mm-hmm. looking at a shared history and saying, well, you were the instigator, we were the innocent. That's really different from what's happening in 1984, though, right?
It is, although I do think that, you know, in those situations, it's not as though they're looking back objectively and drawing different conclusions.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That there's, you know, it's not the right word, but more or less mythology gets built up around, around certain events or certain people that then drives the thinking as they look back or look forward. End of sentence.
Okay.
Isn't that, he said, trying to sound smart, isn't that what they call the Rashomon effect?
Oh, yeah, with the seven different perspectives.
Yeah,
on
I mean,
is,
that sort of sounds like that's what it is. It's like different people experiencing a situation in a way and recounting a situation in a certain way that supports their not only their understanding of it, but the way they want to understand it, the way that makes them sort of feel comfortable with the understanding of it, whatever that means, right? It puts somebody in a better light, in a worse light. It puts them in an advantageous position to oversimplify it. But that sounds like sort of what you're talking about is where you shape your narrative. And in the act of recounting it to somebody, help shape their perspective of the narrative also.
Right. I think what's the difference with 1984 compared to something like that is that perspective is the state's perspective, and they're forcing that upon you.
And that power structure.
You know, so it's not, you don't get a choice to say, this is how I look at things, this is how I'm going to interpret this. It's, and they talk about it with the newspeak, in which they're trying to whittle the language down so there's no nuance. It's just rock, chair, you know, whatever, to take away that possibility that you can draw different conclusions. It's just, there are these very sort of black and white facts, and then you're kind of let know what you're supposed to think about them from the state.
There are so many great fictional franchises out there that make use of the storytelling technique that you were just talking about. And one of the other ones I was thinking of is one of my favorite 90s franchises is The X-Files, that whole idea of the truth is out there and there are conspiracy theories. For all the reasons that you said, Toby, it really works. What are some other franchises where that idea of competing versions of the same reality or a hidden reality come up?
Well, I think, you know, late 60s, early 70s, you know, with the, you know, after the Kennedy assassination, when people were really starting to question whether their sense of, you know, the way the world worked was accurate because of this sort of,
you know, earth-shattering event. I think there's a bunch of them. The parallax view is one that kind of pops to mind as an example of this idea that beneath the surface there's this whole other, you know, what they called today, you know, if you listen to Roger Stone, the deep state.
Yeah,
that's actually kind of running things when people become inconvenient or trying to implement the wrong policy or whatever, they take care of them. So there's a whole bunch of those things. I think winter kills is maybe another one.
The one that came to my mind, and it's maybe one of my favorite TV shows ever, is a 1960s TV show called The Prisoner.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And it was remade in the 2000s at some time. Jim Caviezel takes over the title character, so to speak. But that's pretty much on the nose with what we're talking about. It's where they abduct this former secret agent who abruptly resigns. The plot of the story is that this guy played by the creator Patrick McGoohan abruptly resigns from his job, and he wakes up in the village, this seaside resort. It was filmed in Wales somewhere, I think, right? And they're trying to figure out why he resigned, and he's trying to figure out what's going on, and can he get off the island? And as you quickly learn, the answer is no, he cannot, and all this kind of stuff, right? But it is this sort of state-imposed reality, right? It's very surreal is the word. All of the residents of the village are identified by numbers. He's number six, and the person in charge is number one. And so he's trying to figure out and subvert the process and the hierarchy to figure out what's going on and all of this stuff, right? And so that's, I mean, talk about a governmental entity imposing a reality on a person. That's, I mean, hammer, nail, there you go, right?
Right,
that's,
right.
The Truman Show, I think, is a similar.
Oh, yeah, that's a really, yeah.
Not as harrowing, I guess, but it's another situation where, and he's just completely oblivious to it, but this other reality is going on, and he's not a part of it at all. As a matter of fact, he's a reality of one.
Right, right. So I'm going to get really geeky here. In Star Trek The Next Generation, there's an episode, I believe it is called Chain of Command. Okay, thanks, Mike. And in it, Captain Picard is abducted, and he is held in a futuristic POW camp, basically. And he is made, his captor makes him believe that there is five of something, not four of something. And, you know, I haven't seen the episode in quite a while, but I was a big Next Generation fan growing up, still am. And it was really dramatic, and it echoed that idea. I don't think it was a coincidence that it was the number four and the number five, given that idea of 2 + 2 = 5.
I
wonder.
Just made that connection.
And actually, I am sure that there is someone smarter about Star Trek than me who might be listening to this. And if you know the backstory to that episode, you should email us at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com. Leave us a voice memo. We'd love to hear from you.
I think the new Westworld on HBO is another on a couple of different levels, and that you have people being dropped into this sort of make-believe world of the Old West, plus you have these two realities of these, normal humans, and then these androids basically who are starting to become self-aware and realizing that what their lives basically entail, and that by sort of gaining a consciousness, that kind of changes things for them.
Competing realities, awesome for fiction, awesome for that type of storytelling, really, really problematic for journalists and people looking to ground themselves in a civically responsible life. So what do you guys think the solution is?
This is where the crickets
right.
come in.
Well, I think there's been a lot of effort put into making it so that it's not bridgeable. You know, quite honestly, I think both sides of the political spectrum. And, you know, I think depending on which side you're on, you probably feel fairly strongly that your side is has got the better angle on it. But, you know, I think it's been made so that, for instance, and this is because I'm politically liberal, my perception is that the conservative movement has spent a lot of time trying to undermine the authority of mainstream media so that, and I think this is part of what happened with Trump and why he, you know, from the liberal point of view, gets away with so much, is that, you know, people who are going to support him don't consider it, don't find reading an article in the New York Times to be, you know, a definitive statement about something. They think that that's going to be sort of fatally skewed towards a liberal, and therefore it you can disregard it. And it's the same way, you know, to be fair, like if Breitbart, you know, or the Daily Caller comes up with something, you know, I'm going to look at it with like extreme skepticism if I'm going to look at it at all. So I think it goes both ways. And I don't know. I mean, there's just so much. Like, I don't know how you, like, if I was to think, like, how could you create a media organization that would get buy-in from all ranges of the political spectrum? You know, I don't know how that's, I don't know what qualities you could come up with that would end up with something that would be universally accepted, because I think there's a real disagreement on what the facts are.
And I think that's the problem.
And that's in very dystopian, right? Is that
right.
You can't agree on, you know, just very basic things. That's part of the, you know, when I have political conversations with conservative friends about things, it often breaks down to the point of we just, you know, we can't agree on just like basic facts. So agreeing on like what a policy should be or who's best at addressing something is kind of immaterial, because we're just talking about two completely different things.
Right, right.
To tie a couple of threads from before and follow up on the agreeing about basic facts, back to the inauguration photo idea. Mm-hmm. I think it was the Washington Post that did the survey itself, but they showed the two photos to people who voted for different, at the time, presidential candidates.
Right.
And asked a very simple question. Which photo has more people? Of the group of people that voted for the person who is now president, about 14 or 15% of them said that the photo that had fewer people in it actually had more, and the percentage of people who voted for Hillary Clinton was about 2%. It's not an assumption, but the thinking is, you know, did they do it simply to, I'll use the word spite, the narrative and the idea, like, well, you know, I know what you want me to say. And if I admit that, then I am admitting a larger thing about the candidate that I supported.
Right.
Right. And, you know, so it's not I couldn't count. It's not it was really close. And, you know, there were, you know, seven more people in this picture than the other. Right. It's, you know, it's. I don't think I'm being biased when I say it's clear which picture has more people in it, right? And so the talk, I mean, not even like a policy which has nuances and stuff.
Right.
Like which number is bigger than another number? Hey, weren't we just talking about numbers and stuff? Yeah. But that's disturbing to me.
Well, but I think that's the definition of doublethink, right?
Right.
It's like ignoring your common sense in order to put your views in a narrative.
Right. It's hard because people get emotionally attached to candidates. People get emotionally attached to issues. And I really, you know, and this is something that just years of covering politics and talking to voters has taught me. Most people who are out voting or out working for a candidate, like, they're coming from a really good place. It doesn't matter where they are on the political spectrum. They are out there because they truly believe that the person they are supporting or the issues that they are supporting is going to make the world better in some way, or is going to make their lives or their kids' lives better.
Or save it from some
right, or save it from somebody else. Exactly. And so it's challenging to square that kind of on the ground emotion that you get covering a campaign with just the anger and the disconnect that we see and hear about in the broader news cycle. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in a sense, the term fake news.
Hate that term.
I hate it too. And that aside, right, it almost becomes a knee-jerk reaction to represent anything that I don't like.
Right.
Not even agree with, like just don't like. You know, like, oh, blah, 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 fact, fake news. You know, no. No.
Right. And that also obscures legitimate criticisms of the media because believe me, I mean, journalism is imperfect. We call journalism a practice because that's just what it is. And it's important to have a dialogue with the communities that we're covering. And that kind of dialogue is how we prevent the type of messed up power structures that we read about in dystopian fiction and hear about in dystopian fiction. And if we're all so angry at each other that we're not having that dialogue anymore, I think that's going to cause real problems for a long time to come. All right, audience, it's your turn. Are we living in a post-truth society where 2 + 2 can equal 5? Why or why not? What are some examples? And how do you spot disinformation? And what do you think the way forward is to find a shared set of facts so we can function as an informed society? Talk to us on Twitter at RFDystopia, or send us an email, or better yet, a voicemail at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com. You can also check us out online and leave us a comment at our website, radiofreedystopia.com. Toby, where can people find you online?
I'm on Twitter at TobyBallNH.
Mike, how about you?
I am also on Twitter at Mike Nothnagel, and my last name is Nothnagel.
It's great. You can find me on Twitter at Meg_Heckman. The show is on Twitter at RFDystopia. We're online at radiofreedystopia.com. That's our website. And you should check it out for links to all of the stories and books and movies and TV shows that we've talked about today. We'll also post information on upcoming episodes in case you want to do a little advanced work. And please, 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 before you hop off of whatever application you are listening to this podcast on, share it with your friends, leave a rating on iTunes, tweet it out. That's how we're going to get more listeners and more traction. We really appreciate it. Thanks again to Mike Nothnagel for being here today and also for a little bit of voice work a few weeks ago. And a big thanks to WUNH for letting us use their studio space once again. Finally, we just want to give a huge thank you to Rebecca Lavoie at Partners in Crime Media for production assistance and moral support. Until next time, this is Radio Free Dystopia.
Partners in Crime Media.